This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio. Women have been a big part of country music over the years. Hall of Famers like Patsy Cline and Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn, just to name a few. But for many artists today, country music is still a boys' club. In her new novel, Sarah Creech tells the story of one woman's road to country music stardom. Singer and fiddler Joe Lover, navigates the politics of Nashville as she tries to stay committed to her music's roots. Joe's life is complicated even further after an old flame returns, unearthing parts of her past she would rather forget. The book is called The Whole Way Home, and Sarah Creech joins me now on the program. Hello, Sarah.
Hi, Frank. How are you?
It's good. Good to have you back again. We talked to you about your earlier novel. What was the idea behind The Whole Way Home? What sparked this for you?
Well, I am a music lover. I always have been. I love to dance. I don't play any instruments except for the harmonica. But I wanted to delve into this world because I know quite a few musicians and I really respect that art form quite a bit. And I was sitting at the Thirsty Beaver Saloon here in Charlotte, North Carolina. It's a wonderful dive bar. And I was watching a band called J.P. Harris and the Tough Choices. And you know, as your earlier guests were discussing, they look like train-hopping punks. They have tattoos on both arms, big hipster beards, sort of before everybody else was doing that. And they look like rebels, but they're so committed to the heritage and to the tradition of the music. And I thought, well, what if guys like those could become really famous in Nashville? And I wanted to explore that world.
Well, and I think this does sort of relate to the conversation we had earlier, this kind of commodification. I mean, to be a hipster and to look like you don't care and you're off the grid, you look like everybody else in your downtown neighborhood, drinking your lattes together, talking about the coming revolt. So, but there is that. And then this question of, well, what's authentic? What's the root? And what is the commercialized, commodified version of our music? And I think that's something you really explore in this novel, right?
Yeah. So Joe Lover wants to remain authentic. You know, she's on the verge of being the next queen of country music, but she doesn't want to have to sacrifice her integrity to do so. And her old flame who comes back to, you know, into her life as a top 40 mega superstar in country music. But they grew up together, were first loves, and they promised that, you know, they would get out of Gatesville, Virginia, this rural town that I invented, and go to Nashville to make it together. But they end up sacrificing each other for individual career paths. So JD, her childhood first love, does sell out his career, at least from Joe's point of view. And she doesn't want to go down that road.
And I love the way you weave together these themes, because this is the complication of trying to stay authentic or true to your roots. You can go back to your roots. You can go back to a childhood friend who is at the root of your very life. But as your lives change and as they move in along different paths, the complications set in, not to mention parts of your past, which we shall not mention. But they're important parts of what Joe does not want revealed and, in fact, part of her authentic past. So tell us a little bit more about J.D.
So J.D. Gunn, he's a really mysterious kind of character, and he was very challenging to write. I found it easier to write Joe's point of view, and I had to study a lot of male musicians, you know, through scholarship and through interviews and meeting these guys and going on their tour buses and hanging out with them late night. It was a very exhausting research process.
Hours and hours at the Thirsty Beaver didn't help.
Yes, and in Nashville. Yeah. But, you know, they just have this desire to be very successful, to have their music known. And JD, I'm not sure he would consider himself a sellout at the beginning of the novel, but he sort of, it comes to dawn on him, right, that he had other intentions when he began in the industry than where he ended up. But he's got a group of guys with him. You know, he feels very obligated to his band, so he's not the only one who's successful here. And he feels like he has to continue down this path of fame to help them continue, right, their careers as well. So he feels trapped in some ways by what he's become. And when he reconnects with Joe, that becomes all the more apparent.
All right, so there's a relationship, and let's get to know Joe Lover a little bit better. I'll ask you to read a passage for us that will introduce us a little more deeply to Joe Lover. Would you do that for us?
Sure. I'm going to read from the beginning of chapter one. It's titled The Wrong Chord, and Joe is about to step on the Ryman Auditorium stage to be inducted into the Grand Ole Opry family. Joanne Lover was ready to stand beneath the bright red lights of the Ryman Auditorium. Under those lights, she'd feel more herself than she did hiding here in the darkness. Her band members twisted their tuning pegs while stagehands shifted the electrical cords around like they were making calligraphy on the wooden floor. Jo rocked from heel to toe in her red cowgirl boots. Her earlobes turned pink before she walked on stage. Her upper lip could sweat more than her armpits, which amazed her, and the left side of her mouth twitched. Same thing happened to Elvis, but he made it billion-dollar cool. Jo searched for the king of 70s country music, Phil Dobie, due on stage any minute now to invite her out where all the greats, like Patsy Cline, Dolly Parton, and Loretta Lynn, had once held a microphone and filled the room with their sweet melodies. She'd been waiting her whole life to be standing out there as an Opry member, and she wished to do right by all that talent tonight. Jo crossed her arms and took a deep breath, and as she exhaled, her dress's spaghetti straps slipped off her right shoulder. She returned it to its proper place, then she began adjusting every part of her outfit, lifting her boobs up in the low-cut dress, a navy one with a pattern of tiny red apples, fluffing the bottom part of her dress, smoothing it back out, fluffing it again. She should have followed her instincts and worn her jeans, but her stylist had insisted on this classic outfit for the Opry induction. Her mama would have most certainly agreed. Jo could hear her now. "You're going to church, Joanne. You will not be shameful. You will look nice before God." Back in Gatesville, every Wednesday and Sunday of her childhood, her mama had made her dress up just like this. And just as soon as she could, Jo would tear off that suffocating dress and hike down to the creek behind their shotgun house. She'd stay down there for hours in the shade of the rhododendron and paint her face with the mud from the creek and pretend she was putting on makeup. If her mama ever saw her, she knew she'd accuse her of wearing the devil's mask. Sometimes she painted her feet and legs, too, and then washed them off in the cold water that stayed icy like that year-round. Jo patrolled up and down the creek with a wooden stick in hand. Little minnows nibbled at her feet as she passed. She stacked smooth stones from the creek to make towering sculptures in different places along the way to help mark her path. Robins and cardinals rested on her creations and kept her company. On one of those hikes, Jo discovered her daddy's moonshine jugs anchored in the deepest part of the creek. She helped herself to a sip every now and then. Her mama never noticed. Jo pretended to be queen of a river that had the power to deliver her from the life she was living. The little Cleopatra of Appalachia.
Sarah Creech reading from her new novel, The Whole Way Home. So there you have it. I mean, some of the complexity, because Jo gets to Nashville and is immediately confronted with the experience that a lot of women still have these days in every aspect of the music industry, misogyny, and the fact that it's a boys' club, right?
That's right. And it's not just in the music industry. I'd say in most industries, especially in the arts, women are confronted with sort of a ceiling and a hard road in order to be taken seriously and to be heard.
And the complexity of this, too, because, again, the conflict and the tension between sort of looking very feminine and made up and dolled up to be on the Nashville stage, which should be her choice and her right, on the other hand, also plays into the stereotype, and it's something that Jo has to wrestle with.
Yes, and I'm really fascinated with sort of the way we present ourselves to the world and the different masks we wear in different situations and the chasm between that and our interior lives. And I felt like the onstage, offstage metaphor worked really well for exploring that theme.
Tell us a little bit more about the research. I mean, we joked about this, the fact that you had to spend some time in bars, but you also did do academic research as well as part of this to learn more about the history of country music. Tell us about that.
Well, I started with academic research. I felt like I needed a foundation of knowledge before I sort of jumped into the method acting phase where I was hanging out with musicians and pretending to be on the road. But what I discovered really quickly is that country music, of all genres of music, is the least explored by scholars. So it's been largely ignored, even though it has this rich tradition and blends so many sort of roots music together that captures American history. So Appalachian folk songs, which immigrated from Scotland, but also African-American spirituals, blues, hymns, gospels. But because of its association with, I think, a lot of cultural ills like misogyny and racism, that we've assumed to be, you know, a focus point in the South, I think scholars have stayed away from the music as a subject worthy of discussion. But thankfully, Bill C. Malone is a scholar, and he devoted his entire career to country music. And because of him, we have, at least the beginning of scholarship for this genre. So I started with Bill C. Malone, and then I read a lot of memoirs, autobiographies of the greats, you know, like Hank Williams and Dolly Parton, Loretta Lynn, Tammy Wynette, even Reba McEntire, and a lot of interviews with contemporary country music artists like Margot Price and Kacey Musgraves, just to see what it was, you know, what it's like to be a woman in the industry. And then I had the privilege of going to the Country Music Hall of Fame and studying in the library there. They grant very limited access to the archive, so I was able to watch the very first recording of the Grand Ole Opry and also listen to it and hear D4 Bailey on the harmonica, which is incredible. And I had access to all of their microfiche. So I spent days and days and days at the Country Music Hall of Fame researching, studying.
What's interesting, you talked about Margot Price, and in this, you know, this whole issue of misogyny, there certainly are famous and well-received female artists, but they don't get the kind of play and not in the kind of rotation. And they certainly sense that there is a ceiling, as you suggested, on their careers. Here's Margot Price and her song, This Town Gets Around.
Well, the very first manager I had, he was old enough, he could have been my dad. Took me up for drinks and talk a big talk. He said, darling, sign on the dotted line, kiss my cheek and drink this wine. If you are about me, then you can just walk. I can't count all the times I've been had. Now I know much better than to let that.
Margot Price, This Town Gets Around. I'm talking to Sarah Creech. Her new novel, The Whole Way Home, tells the story of one woman's road to musical stardom. So there it is, enshrined in song. You also talked about you were at the Hall of Fame and the Country Music Hall of Fame, and you talked about some of the research. You also ran into the legendary Jack White while you were doing your research, right?
I definitely did. He walked right into the room. I was the only one there researching on that day. And I had been there for so long that, you know, I didn't pay attention to, you know, the outside world. So when you're researching there, you're in a glass paneled room and people who've come to tour the Country Music Hall of Fame can see you. So often people would stop and put their hands on the glass and look at me like I was an exhibit. And I could see Elvis's gold-plated car from my seat. So when Jack White walked in, I didn't really look at first. I kind of glanced over my shoulder. And I thought, oh, well, that's interesting. People are coming in. No one's come in 3 days. And then I did a double take, and I thought, who, that very tall, dark, interesting man, he looks familiar. And then it quickly dawned on me who it was. And I became very starstruck. It's never happened to me before, but I have a lot of respect for his talent. And he had an entourage and walked through.
Well, talent, and we should say also somebody who has deep respect for and has promoted the kind of the roots and the deep history of the music, in many cases over and against the commercialization, right? I mean, he's the guy, although he is certainly a commercial success.
Absolutely. He has such a great ear for authentic music. And in fact, Margot Price, who we just listened to, signed with Jack White at Third Man Records. He discovered her even though she'd been in the business for a decade trying to be heard and going through all these harrowing experiences as a woman and being taken advantage of. But he's the one who found her, and you know, now she's rising quickly.
That said, tell us what he said to you when he walked in.
I feel embarrassed even repeating this story. It's a good one. So he walked in, though, and the room was empty. And as he passed, because he's Jack White, he said, well, there sure are some pretty girls in the room today. And, you know, he's Jack White, so he can say that. And it did make me laugh. I needed to laugh. I'd been there for 3 days. But it was also just this extreme charm and charisma that came over me, I think, when he did that. I mean, even the, I feel like he charmed the books in the room also.
Well, and he became part of JD's character. Is that right?
He did. So I realized that I wasn't writing my male main character the way I needed to. He needed to be more mysterious like Jack, bigger in his personality and more charismatic. And so, frankly, I kind of started from scratch when I went home as a result of passing and crossing this path with Jack White. So
you started from scratch. Now, did you stay in touch with him to get a better feel for sort of who J.D. Gunn was now becoming?
You know, I definitely stalked all of his interviews on Google. I've probably read every single Jack White interview that exists. And I wrote to him just to let him know that how he had inspired me. And he remembered me and he wrote me back a really, really generous letter, which I will, and handwritten, and which I will always keep.
How has writing this book shaped your perception of country music?
Well, I grew up in Lynchburg, Virginia, and I listened to a lot of top 40 country since, you know, the 90s. But you know, there was a lot of Reba McEntire, too, Garth Brooks, really great artists, but a lot of forgettable country music as well. And I didn't know the history of the genre. So each novel that I write is an opportunity for me to research more. And so I learned a lot about this tradition and came to respect it very deeply as a result of writing the novel.
And develop a taste for whiskey, no doubt. I'm just guessing. No,
well, that I did. There's a lot of Dickel whiskey in the novel. I'm sort of waiting for Dickel to send me a case of whiskey.
There you go. Product placement. The novel may not make you a lot of money, though it is wonderfully written, but the endorsements, that's where you make the money, Sarah.
That, hopefully. We will see.
Sarah Creech. Her new novel is called The Whole Way Home. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
You can find out more about the novel at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program produced by Anita Rao, Charlie Shelton Orman, Laura Pelliser, and Jennifer Brooklyn. Al Widarski is sitting in for Robin Copley today. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.